This is the Canadian Mountain Podcast, brought to you by the Canadian Mountain Network. This is episode one of the Canadian Mountain Podcast. This episode was recorded on September 22, 2016. A panel discussion entitled, Doing Research in the Satu Region of the Mackenzie Mountains in the Northwest Territories.
Well, welcome to a Canadian Mountain Network podcast. This is the first of what we hope will be several on the Canadian Mountains. And I should tell you, the Canadian Mountain Network is a voluntary alliance of universities, governments, Indigenous communities, NGOs, and businesses. And we're all dedicated to the sustainability of mountain environments and communities. Today, we're going to be talking about doing research in the Mackenzie Mountains of the Northwest Territories. Challenges, things that have happened in the past, plans for the future. So this is going to be a really interesting introduction. To those of you who don't know the Mackenzie Mountains, this is a big mountain range right on the boundary between the Northwest Territories and the Yukon, far up north in Canada. Within that, the particular area we're concerned with is called the Satu region. It's one of five administrative areas in the Northwest Territories. It runs from Great Bear Lake westward to the Yukon Northwest Territory boundary, which is about 800 kilometers east-west. North to south, the distance is nearly 600 kilometers. So this is a big area. It includes a good stretch of the Mackenzie River and much of the Mackenzie Mountains. It has been home for many thousands of years to the Satu Dene people. More recently, the Satu have been joined by Métis people and non-Aboriginal immigrants. In 1993, both groups signed a comprehensive land claim agreement with the federal government that resulted in this enormous Satu region. It is an unforgiving environment, part of Canada's northernmost boreal forest, the taiga. Winters are long, dark, and very cold. Summers are short and cool, with incredibly long days. This has been a land for hunters and gatherers, and not farmers. Surviving here has demanded highly specialized traditional skills and knowledge. Traditional knowledge among the Satu has been transmitted orally from generation to generation. Some of the oral history and traditional practices have been documented by early missionaries and fur traders, and more recently by anthropologists and community researchers. The Mackenzie Mountains are a particularly beautiful and challenging part of the Satu region. Much remains to be studied and understood about the physical environment, the wildlife, and the archaeological record. Well, what is it like to do research here? What can traditional knowledge contribute? How can researchers from educational institutions, industry, and government work together with the people who live here to increase our knowledge and appreciation of one of the world's great mountain ranges? And these are the kinds of questions we are asking today. We've got four people ready to talk to you and me. My name is Ben Gadd. I'm a writer and a naturalist who has never been to the Mackenzie Mountains and is really looking forward to hearing a lot about them today. We also have with us Heather Sayin, Tom Andrews, Deborah Simmons, Leon Andrew. So these are all people who are going to help to answer the questions we have laid out for them. Maybe I should let these participants introduce themselves. Why don't we start with Heather? Heather, tell us about you.
Hi, Ben. So as you mentioned, my name is Heather Sayin. I've been living here in Norman Wells within the Satu region for about 6 years now. Recently took on a job as the Manager of Wildlife Research and Monitoring with the Government of Northwest Territories. So I oversee some of the wildlife research and monitoring programs that occur within the Satu region. And so we haven't had too many programs out in the Mackenzie Mountains, but I would love to see more work being done out there and have some great ideas on how we can do that.
Right. Tom, tell us a bit about yourself.
Oh, hi, Ben. Tom Andrews here. I'm the Territorial Archaeologist and Manager of the Cultural Places Program with the Government of Northwest Territories. Our offices are based in Yellowknife at the Prince of Wales Northern Heritage Centre, the Territorial Museum. I've been an archaeologist here in the Northwest Territories for, with government for 27 years now. And for the last 11, I've partnered with another member of the team here today, Leon Andrew, in doing archaeological research in the Mackenzie Mountains.
Well, Leon, we should get you to introduce yourself next then.
Hi, Ben. My name is Leon Andrew. I was born and raised in Toledo, and currently I live in Auburn Wells. And I do a lot of traditional knowledge research for people that are interested in that area, Mackenzie Mountain. So that's where I'm coming from at the moment.
Okay, well, that just leaves us with Deborah. Tell us about what you're doing, Deborah.
Sawtoo Renewable Resources Board, and I'm fortunate to get to work in that capacity with Leon, who's also a special advisor for the board, among others. And that board was created by the Sawtoo Dene Métis Comprehensive Land Claim Agreement, which encompasses that area of the Mackenzie Mountains as well. And as we are known to be the main instrument of wildlife management in the Sawtoo region, but we also have a very strong mandate in research, and we facilitate, for example, the Sawtoo Environmental Research and Monitoring Forum, which includes community and university and government folks working together to think strategically about how good research can happen in the region. And also, I have had the good fortune to spend quite a few years since 99, not as many as Tom, working in the Sawtoo region with a focus on traditional knowledge research. So people who are much more expert than I, like Leon, have been close collaborators in helping to bring together scientists and traditional knowledge holders to pursue research questions of common interest.
So there we are. We have four of us here. I'll just go over the names one more time. Heather Sain Crawford, Tom Andrews, Deborah Simmons, Leon Andrew, and I'm Ben Gadd, your host. Shall we get right into the questions? This is where this is really going to take off, because I'm expecting to hear some interesting stories from you when we answer these questions. So the first one is, what is it like to do research in the Mackenzie Mountains of the Sawtoo region? What challenges do you face from the weather and the isolation, from those hordes of mosquitoes in the summer and the minus 40 temperatures in the winter? Or are they minus 50 temperatures in the winter? All I know is it's very cold. Who would like to start on that one?
Well, when people ask that kind of question, I actually find myself thinking about how much I've learned from the Dene and Métis people that I've been able to work with about this place that often is perceived from the visitors as kind of a hostile, forbidding place, but for them it's the most beautiful, rich homeland. And I find that if I'm traveling with Dene people as my hosts, I am in the lap of luxury. There is very little privation. We eat well. We live in a very, very comfortable wall tent with fragrant spruce bough floor. We know how to locate the campsite so that it's comfortable and out of the wind, and we know how to deal with those mosquitoes. So for me, it's not a place of suffering. It's a place of a great enjoyment and so much to learn and explore.
Sounds to me that this can almost be fun sometimes, never mind the mosquitoes.
Well, it's a breath amazingly beautiful place. There's no getting around. This may be understood because it's so far north as somewhere that's so hostile, but no, we are looking at a place where every corner is another kind of memorable picture to look at and to be part of. And it's a homeland, and Leon can speak better to this than I, that has so much history as well. And the stories that people have about that place and their place names help to bring it alive as well as not just a wilderness, but also as a place of a lot of rich culture.
Yeah, so I just have to echo what Deb had said about the Mackenzie Mountains and the Sawtooth region in general, is that we have one of the most beautiful spots, I feel, in the Northwest Territories. When I first came up to the Sawtooth and to Norman Wells, I was never a mountain person, and I was able to first go out to the mountains on a Dall sheep survey with my predecessor, and was just completely in awe of the beauty out there. To get up and see the view, to have the chance to see a number of different animals, and to be so remote is really special. Knowing that there's no communities out there, there are not a lot of people out there. There's probably a good 100 miles between us and the next group of people. But in terms of challenges, there are quite a few. So you have to be ready far in advance. There are a lot of logistical challenges. So most of our work, most of our research work we do is with either airplanes or helicopters. So setting that up well ahead of time, which means a lot of money as well. But just being flexible. So as you mentioned, weather. When you're out there in June, July, you have to be ready for any season. When we go out for our Dall sheep surveys, we're on the ground, and I am ready for it to wake up to 4 inches of snow on the ground, and just basically to be ready for anything. So when you're that remote, when you're that far away from any type of assistance, you need to be ready and you need to be self-sufficient. So there are a lot of challenges, but I think they're well worth it.
Now, you were mentioning Dall's sheep there. I think for the benefit of people who are not really sure what a Dall sheep is, maybe you can describe this very northerly wild sheep for us.
Right. So the Dall sheep is a thin-horn sheep, so related to the bighorn sheep that you would see around Banff, just a smaller in size. And the Dall sheep are white in color. So completely white all year round. Quite beautiful, striking animals on the landscape.
Well, perhaps we should move directly on to Leon here. Maybe you could give us an idea of what this area means to you.
Hi, my name is Leon Andrew. The mountain wasn't Sawtooth, you know. Sawtooth is huge. Mackenzie Mountain, you know, the west side of the Mackenzie River is a vast area. And there's still a lot of unknown over there. And the difficulty, the challenges to get into those countries, it's kind of a rugged area. So the best way to get in there perhaps was air and stuff like that, air transportation rather. And once you're out there, you know, it's beautiful. Like Debson was talking about, the country is beautiful. You have beautiful river and high mountain. It was all sort of wildlife. And if you're thinking research, I think that's a place to go. You know, if once you're out there, you know, you can do a lot. And Western Sawtooth, you know, our people rely a lot on wildlife for food. So research means a lot to us if there's a way to do it. And I'll stop there. Let's see.
I'm thinking that caribou might be a really important species to everyone up there.
Yeah, Leon again, yeah. Like wildlife and the caribou, they're very important to us. We're kind of situated in the Sawtooth, like in the Mackenzie Mountain. We have an old road, it's called Cano Road. It's kind of open on the Yukon side, so we have a lot of access people and access in that area. So we do have concerns about the wildlife also. And I'll leave it there again.
So, Leon has talked a little bit about concerns that people have due to the access that people have into the mountain area by way of the Canal Road from the Yukon. And so several of the communities are taking action, and recently they met in Tulita to talk about how they can make a conservation plan that would include a research and monitoring plan for caribou in that area of concern. And it's kind of an exciting opportunity for community-driven conservation that involves not just one community, but three crossing two jurisdictions, that is, including Ross River Dene people across the border in the Yukon territory as well, because that's a shared territory traditionally. And it's been a really great pleasure to see people in dialogue about their knowledge of that area and their interest in sharing stories as a way to think forward about plans for the land in that area.
Now, the name Kennel Road has popped up a couple of times here, and I bet some of our listeners would like to know what that is. Could somebody maybe briefly just tell us what the Kennel Road is and how it got to be there, whether it's still there or not?
Tom Andrews here. The Kennel Project was started in 1944. It was an effort of the Canadian and U.S. military to build a pipeline between the oil refinery in Norman Wells over the mountains to Whitehorse. And the goal was to provide a refined product to help the U.S. protect the west coast of North America and Alaska particularly. The pipeline was built over quite arduous conditions. They had to go over two passes at 6,000 feet and required many pump stations and other infrastructure along the way. I think that if you were to go back and interview some of the Army Corps of Engineers who worked on it, they would have complained bitterly about cold and bugs and whatever. Most of us who work in the mountains today have new ways of dealing with those things, but in those days it was a very tough job. Anyway, the pipeline was completed months before the war ended, so it really only pumped for a short period of time. And when the war ended, the pipeline was demobilized. The trail or the road that that ran along beside it stayed in place, and the Yukon has maintained that as a road. So you can drive from Whitehorse or Dawson right up to the Continental Divide on the Yukon Road. On the Northwest Territory side, it's still a trail, and our Department of Industry, Tourism, and Investment is interested in partnering with local communities to create a territorial park there for hikers and others who want to travel down through this incredibly beautiful landscape.
I wonder, roughly in kilometers, how long the Kennel Road might be. Anybody have a figure?
I know. From the Mackenzie River to the Divide, it's about 224 miles, or maybe a bit further than that, and probably the same or so on the other side. I don't know exactly, but I would estimate 400 to 500 miles in length. So,
this sounds to me like one way of getting into the Mackenzie Mountains to do research that doesn't require a helicopter.
Indeed, if you wanted to drive up the Yukon side, you could get all the way to, as I said, basically the top of the world in the Northwest Territories. And GNWT, our government, maintains a wildlife check station there that doubles as a bit of a research station as well at a place called Mile 222 on the Kennel. And many researchers, myself and Leon included, and Deb, I think, as well, use this infrastructure in order to reduce the cost of working in the mountains. We can bring helicopter fuel, for example, in by truck as opposed to flying it in, which is much more expensive.
Well, that does lead right into the second question here. What's the cost of doing research in this area, and how is it funded these days?
Well, it's Tom again. I think we should all probably chip in on this one, but I think we'd all agree that cost working in the Mackenzie Mountains is very, very high. It's an incredibly remote region, despite the canal road that leads to mile 222. Getting into the mountains is very expensive. It requires either you can travel up by jet boat on the a few rivers, the Keel being the most important one, into the Mackenzie Mountains. The only other way really to get into the NWT side of it is to fly, and that's float planes. I think there are 13 lakes in the Mackenzie Mountains where you can land a float plane. And then otherwise you have to rely on helicopter transportation. Helicopters run, anywhere between $1,600 and $2,500 an hour with fuel, and it's an incredibly expensive proposition to begin a long-term research project in the mountains. Funding comes from some from internally from GNWT, but quite a large portion of our funding comes from outside research pots that we all take advantage of.
Well, I'm thinking, Tom, while we've got you on here, that doing research in this area, in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, might have been somewhat different. What was it like in the early days, and what kind of projects might have been carried on?
Well, you mentioned the 50s. In the mid to late 50s, a French geographer by the name of Jean Michel walked up into the mountains with the mountain Dene, the Chute Hautenay. In fact, Leon was just a young boy and accompanied Jean Michel then. And he came back home. He lives in Paris. He wrote several ethnographies based on his research in Canada. He also worked in the Kiewit and other places, but he walked up into the mountains in summertime. People traveled very traditionally in the 1950s still. Families would just walk. They have, two or three dogs each with dog packs carrying their personal possessions. Everybody would have their own backpack on. Men would have their gun over their shoulder, and women would walk with a stick. And I read and heard from elders that in the old days, sometimes women would have a bow with them, and they would shoot small birds and hare and things like that. And when they reached their destination, at least since the late 1800s, people would sometimes build a moose skin boat. A boat up to 45 feet long and covered with 7 to 8 moose skins, green moose hides, and bring the summer or year supplies of fur and meat out of the mountains to trade at the post in the valley. Anyway, Michea did exactly that. He walked up with the Andrew and Horsey and other families, Mountain Dene families, spent some time with them. I'm not sure how far they went. But they then came out of the mountains with a moose-skin boat, and quite a remarkable journey for him.
I'm wondering if Leon was too young to remember any of that, but if he does, I wonder if he could maybe give us a story from those days when he was traveling with his family up there.
Yeah, Leon again here. Yeah, I was a little bit young at the time. I do recall here and there. But I do remember this guy, his name was Michel, he didn't walk with us. When we started out Toledo, we went about 30 miles on the other side, we camped there, and then our grandparents and the rest caught up with us, and along came this guy. And apparently he only spoke French, Paris French, so it was very hard to understand. Nobody understood that. But one of the Bavard, his name was Pierre Bavard, he went to school here and learned the French language. So he came along, and then he was kind of interpreting a little bit for Grandpa, I believe. He was always hang around with Grandpa. I remember that. I don't know how they communicated, but they did. That's what I remember here and there. But, you know, they did make that trip all the way across from Toledo, across the country and into the Keel River. And they made two boats. I know that. I remember they made two boats because they had two separate camps. And they came out that way. I recall that. Yeah. It was very unusual to find somebody from somewhere else out of the country to come walking with us. And we didn't understand what he says. Thank you.
You know, so far we've been talking about the summertime, haven't we? And I'm just wondering if there was any research done in the wintertime. I imagine that Leon's family might have traveled quite a bit in the winter. I don't know. What can you tell us, Leon, about traveling in the winter in this area?
In the winter, you know, I would say later in the month, like February, March, it's a good time to do that. We're way up there because you get some overflow and so on. But I remember in the past, you know, when we, from Toledo, we're going to the Mackenzie Mountain. Not way up there high, but we go three-quarter ways in the area called Moosehorn. And at the time, you know, Deb's father was there with us. Came out with there with dog team, and it worked out very well for him, I think, to get from location to location. It's all been done by dog team by then. Today, the schedule is different, and the cause is still there, but, you know, with dog team, you can get around quite reasonably. And today, with schedule, is lots of overflow, kind of slow you down a lot, too. There must be.
And I guess for those people who aren't terribly familiar with the north, there's always the advantage up there that everything is frozen up, and all those swamps and lakes and marshy areas that would have given you trouble in the summer are pretty easy to travel with sleds and dogs in the winter. Would you use dog sleds?
Yeah, during that time in the 60s, everybody still used dog team and snowshoes. And they had to break trail for a dog team, and then, you know, the dog just followed you behind. And yes, during that time, it was really good. Easy to do with dog team, maybe half the time. If you don't have the time, then, you know, dog team is kind of a little bit slow, but, you know, that's the way it's been done traditionally. Yeah. Thank you.
Now, maybe we could get into, just to finish up on question three here. We've been talking about research of some kinds, but not really saying what it was in the past. And I'd like to know a little bit about what's being done currently. So perhaps one or more of you could just give a brief description of the kinds of research that have been done out there, and then what kind of research is being carried on these days.
Well, it's Tom Andrews here again. I'll just mention two long-term research projects that happened in the past. To some extent, Deb Simmons' father, Norman Simmons, was a wildlife biologist who worked in the Mackenzie Mountains for many years. He later went on to become a wildlife administrator with government as well. But his research was really groundbreaking, especially with his dull sheep work. He, a generation and a half ahead of when it became popular and common to do so. Norman Simmons worked collaboratively with local people and really relied on the mountain dené to help provide for his safety and his security while he was in the mountains, help feed him, but also help him with research methods as well. So, he was a generation ahead in terms of the idea of interdisciplinarity, where, you know, he would use his methods as a research biologist and bring in traditional hunting methods that the mountain dené would use and combine them and use that as a way of studying various species in the mountains. A great example of that was a number of mountain elders worked with him to build a caribou fence, which is a traditional entrapment device. People would kill caribou to generate lots of meat, which they would trade at the mountains. But for the wildlife surveys, they used the caribou fence to lead the caribou to a corral where Norman would fix radio collars to them. And this was in 1964 that they built this fence on the Keel River. And so this is a fantastic example of interdisciplinarity, how, you know, the methods of a scientist can be combined with the methods of a traditional knowledge holder and create a new way of approaching a shared objective. And so Norman was really a generation ahead of that. The other person that I would highlight is a professor emeritus at University of Alberta, Peter Kershaw, who worked out of mile 222, so right at the top of the world in the Sachu region in the Mackenzie Mountains, for over 40 years. And he has this incredible longitudinal set of data, 40 years of ecology in that area. His particular interest was on pulses and ground ice, and he also looked at the impacts of the Camel Road. We talked about that earlier. It ended up, I think, leaking more oil than it pumped, and so he studied the impacts of that over a long period of time as well. So that's two examples of very important research that's gone on in the region in the past.
And then just very briefly, Tom, or someone who's engaged in research projects these days, is there any particular thing you'd like to point out that's ongoing right now?
So I guess just adding to what Tom said, here in our office, we started dull sheep surveys out in a couple of different survey areas, and that was looking back at Norm Simmons' data and thinking that we needed something long-term, and that gave us a lot of information. So we have, we currently run in two study areas, dull sheep surveys in June, looking at just after lambing has occurred. So we go out and we are on the ground. We get dropped off by helicopter and classify everything within each of those study areas within about a week to 10 days. So currently, right now, that is what we, the only long-term research plan that we have out there. However, there are some other things that do occur. So we have outfitted hunts that happen within the Mackenzie Mountains. So we have a number of outfitters that bring in hunters from around the country and around the world. And we have gotten their observations for a number of years. So we have a long-term observational data set there, which is really important and really actually rich. And so along with those, we have, you know, observations, not just the things that they hunt, but also things like pikas that are becoming more and more important with climate change. We also have some sporadic mountain caribou work. So mountain caribou are a very important species, as has been brought up. And over this call. So there has been some things that have been done with them. So at opportune times, there were some classification surveys done. And then there have also been some contaminant work done. So this is actually spearheaded out of the Decho region, which is the administrative region just to the south of the Sawtooth, still within the Mackenzie Mountains. There have been and still are concerns about the health of the food that people are eating. And so out of that came some contaminant work looking at the mountain caribou, the moose, the dall sheep, and the mountain goats, and looking at what condition those animals were in.
Well, we've heard quite a bit about wildlife monitoring and investigations, and of course we had a little talk about ecological work as well. What about the physical sciences side, geology, weather, that sort of thing? I mean, do you have geologists exploring for minerals, oil and gas, that sort of thing going on in the Mackenzie Mountains?
Yes, there is geological work happening. Of course, that comes and goes with the I guess, economic market that we're currently in? Or so the geological work will come and go depending on the economy and the market for the whatever they are looking for out there. So some summers when I'm out there, there are a lot of helicopters around, and some summers, like two summers ago, there was nothing out there. So it does, it's it comes and goes in waves. Other than that, we don't, so one of the things that I would love to see is more weather stations, and this is across the north, but we don't have a weather station in the Mackenzie Mountains. There is nothing out there. So, you know, we have to take inferences from climate models, and it would be amazing to have a year-round weather station, say, out at Mile 222, which is the government-run check station that was brought up before on the Canal Road.
And, of course, let's not forget the long history of Dene occupation here and so on. I wonder if there's any archaeological work, anthropological sort of work that's gone on in the Mackenzie Mountains.
There have been a number of archaeologists that have worked in the Mackenzie Mountains and a few anthropologists as well. Starting with the anthropology, I've already mentioned Jean Michea, who, though he was a geographer, he worked much like an anthropologist. Later, Burl Gillespie, student of the famous anthropologist June Helm, worked with the Mountain Dene and documented the construction and use of something called a moosekin boat, a very important innovation the Mountain Dene brought into the world in the late 1800s in order to bring large amounts of meat out of the mountains to trade at Fort Norman. This was in response to the need for meat because of the near extinction of bison on the plains. The moosekin boat is kind of an iconic, or it's a cultural icon, I would say, of the Mountain Dene today. And Burl Gillespie's recording and film that was made by the National Film Board and a Mountain Dene producer by the name of Raymond Yakalaya at the time, this was 1981, stands as one of the most important anthropological pieces of the region. In terms of archaeology, there have been a handful of archaeologists, one that my predecessor here at the museum worked in the mountains for many years doing research along the Keel River and Drum Lake and a few other places in the mountains. His name was Chris Hanks. Leon and I have partnered on a high alpine ice patch study for 11 years now. These are ice patches that exist on the north face of mountains. They are remnants of last year's snow that build up over many, many years. They're not big enough to be classed as glaciers because they don't actually move, but they're critical habitat for mountain caribou during summertime. The caribou seek them out in the afternoons after eating down lower as a way of regulating their temperature and escaping parasitic biting flies. And hunters figured this out thousands of years ago and climb up the backside of mountains with rounded tops and come over the crest, and there would be the caribou on the ice and within the effective range of their ancient dart throwing technology or archery technology. We know from what we know now, I guess, is that the Mountain Dene have occupied and used this region for at least 6,000 years. Our oldest site in the mountains is 6,000 years old. In fact, it was a place that Leon found a couple of years ago. He found a piece of a birch dart that dated to 6,000 years ago. We expect that people were there probably another 2,000 years before that, but we've not yet found the archaeology to support that. Certainly oral tradition does, but archaeology needs to catch up with that yet. So.
Well, that leads right into our next question about traditional knowledge. I know that this is playing more and more of a role in scientific research these days. I wonder if Leon could explain what traditional knowledge is and how it might be used in some of these investigations.
Leon here. Traditional knowledge. That's something we've been talking about a lot here over the past year or so. with the government. Traditional knowledge is something that that they do on hand, you know, like fences, fish trap, and stuff like that. People see things, and they study it, and they make tools to make that work for them. That's what we, I think, traditional knowledge is. And over the years, I think Tom just said, you know, we still got to catch up with the oral history, and it makes sense to say that, because traditional knowledge is, I go back and say, the tools have been made from studying wildlife, how they act, you know, you make tools for such purposes. And those are traditional knowledge to us. And our traditional knowledge too is speak to the weather every day, every week. Our elder used to read the signs on the sky when the sun is setting, and they can tell us stories about what the five-day forecast would be. Some are very accurate, and some, but today that's kind of far in between. So traditional knowledge is there's a lot of traditional knowledge involved. And we can find ways to implement that with the government and scientists. It would be good for us. I must say.
Yeah, this is Debbie. I just wanted to add that one way of thinking about traditional knowledge, if you're a scientist, is that there's a baseline there that long predates any documented scientific research. And so for my father, for example, Norm Simmons, it was really critical for him to be able to learn from the knowledge holders that he traveled with in order to develop his research questions, and also to develop his research design, because if he had not had that assistance, I think he would have come up dry on a lot of his research results. His efforts would have been way less rich and productive.
It's Tom here. Could I add on to that, please? I think that Deb has really hit the nail on the head here. You know, as an archaeologist, I have, a learned knowledge and skills that go with that discipline, but left to my own resources in the Mackenzie Mountains, my success rate would be much, much less than, you know, much less than when I work collaboratively with Leon and other elders from the Mountain Dene. And in fact, all of our research is conducted that way. And as a result, we're able to rely heavily on Leon's knowledge of the mountains, and that way I think we do a much better job together than we would have independently. And you know, and so in many ways Norm Simmons kind of broke the trail for us that way, and we're all following in his methods since then. One last thing, the other point that's important to make, and I think Leon said it very, very nicely, is we often think of traditional knowledge as being, kind of like book knowledge. You know, it's data recorded in people's brains or whatever. I think that the bulk of traditional knowledge exists in skills and practices that people have. So it's knowing, how to make a moose skin boat or a birch bark canoe, or how to, you know, where to put a hole in the ice to set a net to catch fish, or to, you know, where to build the caribou fence, understanding caribou behavior and actions, past actions in that area, so you know that you're going to intercept them, and those kinds of things. And, you know, as an archaeologist, learning the skills and practices is very, very important, because those are the things that leave traces on the landscape. And so for us, it's really critical to work collaboratively with people to learn those things, and a very important aspect of our research.
Yeah, if I may, Ben, Leon here. One of the mechanisms within the land team, we have a Satu Land and Water Board. Every time companies or they're going to do some work out in the hills or wherever. They are required to do a traditional knowledge research prior to their work. So we have a mechanism there that may happen, maybe it does happen. But other than that, everything else is, you know, we're just kind of negotiating, working together and trying to make things work in our favor, but it's still getting there. Anyway, that's what I wanted to add. Thank you.
Well, before we leave this topic, isn't it true that traditional knowledge also includes the looking back through the history of a place as to what has happened long before the scientists came along to investigate it? I wonder if one of you could speak to that.
Our oral history is not recorded, but we have a lot of stories that talk to the past. Our ancestors have a rich knowledge about their oral history, talk to how the world was or how it became to in their perspective. And we still carry those stories. And what today's world, like, you know, we have climate change, it's happening out there. And we like to be a part of that. I know the scientists are working very hard to understand why it's getting so warm out there. And to a certain extent, they have said that certain things have caused it. But us, in general, the people in the Métis have noticed the change on the ground itself. And yeah, our history goes way back, you know, can go on and on, talk about it all night. So I'll just leave it at that. Thank you.
I just wanted to add that an important part of traditional knowledge is the Dene language and the concepts that are embodied in the language and the place names that are, as has been said in at least one paper, indicators of ecological knowledge as well, and history. And so we've found that working with Dene language is really critical to being able to illuminate some of the research questions and also the ways of interpreting some of the technical aspects of the knowledge that people practice. That's a challenge and an opportunity, I think, for visiting researchers.
Well, we're going to have to wrap this up pretty quickly, but we still have one question left, and I wonder if each of you could very briefly give us an idea of some of the major research priorities for the region, say, in the next 5 years. What would you like to see, just briefly?
Well, Tom Andrews here. For us, climate change, I think, is our prime directive these days, understanding the impacts of that. Alpine ice is melting at alarming rates, and you know, for thousands of years, they've preserved very well these amazing artifacts. And with as the ice melts, these artifacts are exposed and are lost to, you know, wind and caribou trampling and all sorts of things. And it's quite an urgent issue, and it'll be one of our major focuses. We also worry a lot about the increased incidence of wildfire in throughout the Northwest Territories and the mountains as well, and large wooden surface features like caribou fences, for example, are a threat from that, and that, of course, is linked to climate change as well. So I think that sort of sums up our priorities for the coming years.
And this is Deborah speaking, and I think that we are working toward addressing community concerns and questions about the mountain caribou. We're fortunate to be collaborating with Dr. Micheline Molso, Trent University, and with Parks Canada on work that combines traditional knowledge and genetics research to better understand the populations and their distribution, because we understand from traditional knowledge that there are distinct populations and that need to be that conservation efforts need to recognize those subpopulations of the larger herd. So further research that can be addressing people's concerns that research be respectful and non-invasive are quite possible, I think, moving forward and being strongly supported, I think, by Parks Canada right now.
Leon Andrew here. My final thought on your last question is I also think about climate change. You know, we have water that, you know, the temperature is coming up. There was concern to our people at home. And the ice melt that Tom mentioned, and that's another one too. And we have a lot of erosion along the big river, and those are the concerns. So I'm on the same page with them if it comes to climate change, and must see very much if they can, if we can, we can find a way to include TK in traditional knowledge with science. Maybe that's helpful. I don't know, but that's something I'd like to say, must say.
Heather, do you have anything to add on that one?
Yeah, so as everyone has mentioned, the importance of mountain caribou is clear. We still have many people who rely on mountain caribou. So moving forward with addressing, as Deb said, community concerns around our northern mountain caribou would be a major priority for the coming years. But there are also, we have several federally listed mammals out in the Mackenzie Mountains, including grizzly bear and pikas that could be looked at. There's also the opportunity to look at dall sheep. So there have been some concerning trends from elsewhere. So Alaska has seen some scary trends in their populations. So maybe we should start looking a little bit broader at our dall sheep, two small study areas within the vast mountain range. It's just a drop in the bucket, really.
Well, I think we should probably wrap up here. Let's see, we've been taking some notes as you've been speaking. So let's just quickly review some of the things we've said here. Of course, there's a lot of research you can do in this area. You got to be ready for any kind of weather. You have a lot of communities coming together to create research and monitoring plans. We discussed the Cannell Road, which is an interesting project in Canadian history. Cost of research, well, that's a pretty simple answer, a lot to work up there. We discussed the work of Jean Michel back in the 1950s. We discussed briefly some of these ways of getting in there, the moose skin boats and so on, and the dog teams traveling about in the old days. And I presume nowadays it's going to be snowmobiles and that kind of thing. Current research, we have the dall sheep surveys. We have mountain caribou work on that. You've got hunters coming into that area from around the world, so they get observational data. And I guess you kind of have to keep an eye on these folks, too. We'd like to have more weather stations in the area. We've got anthropological studies. We've got a lot of archaeology that's been done. And, of course, the traditional knowledge is coming in more, both for ways of getting work done up there, but, of course, looking back through the oral history of the people who have lived there as to what things have been like for these different kinds of wildlife and the people who have lived with them all those years. And then just getting back to what we'd really like to know, climate change kept popping up as a big, big issue up there. And, of course, the further north you go on the planet, the more climate change we are seeing. And I'm sure it's affecting you a great deal. And then you have community concerns about the mountain caribou. You've got some genetic research going on there. This is something we have to be respectful and non-invasive about, because these species have to be taken care of. And we had a mention of some endangered species work up there, grizzly bears, the pikas, and so on. So if that sounds roughly like what we should have covered today, that's great. Does anybody like to add something right at the end? Maybe something you just want to say about doing work up in the Mackenzie Mountains there? Anybody?
Well, I'd like to say something. I didn't get a chance to answer the first question. I think the way that I often represent my privilege to be able to work with Leon and other elders in the mountains and to live in or work in that incredibly beautiful place, I call them pinch me moments. They're those times in life where you're in a place that's so beautiful you can't believe you're there, and you have to pinch yourself to to kind of, you know, you're not in a dream. This is real. What you're looking at is real, and it really is that a lot of the time. And I can, you know, remember so many times us sitting on the side of a mountain, that, you know, 5 or 6 or 7,000 feet, and this incredible vista below us and around us, and eating our lunch and just having one of those moments where, you know, wow, it's just it really is something else.
Anyone else have a parting thought for us?
Hi, it's Heather. So I did just want to mention that there are a tremendous number of opportunities. But one of the most rewarding things about doing research up here is really getting to work with people. So, you know, this has been kind of the theme that we've been talking about in the people that are here. Working with them to understand their concerns and building something, building a research project around that, and being able to come back to them with an answer to a question they asked you 3 years ago, that's hugely rewarding. And it's one of my favorite parts of my job, is to be able to come back and actually say, yes, we did this.
Anyone else?
Yeah, I guess this is Deborah speaking, and one of the things that we try to do is really welcome new researchers to the region. The Sawtooth Environmental Research and Monitoring Forum that we help to facilitate and that Leon is part of is an ideal opportunity for anybody who's interested in pursuing some research with communities of the Sawtooth region, and in particular it would be Norman Wells and Tulita that are most concerned about the mountains, as well as Fort Good Hope further north. That's a venue for testing out preliminary questions and further developing them and building relationships that can be long-term, and that's people hugely appreciate that kind of engagement early on at the very inception of a project. So I would really encourage anybody who's interested in starting research in the Sawtooth to get in touch with us and start a conversation and build a relationship, because that I know it will be very rewarding in the end.
Well, let's thank our podcast participants. We've had Heather Saeem Crawford, Tom Andrews, Leon Andrew, and Deborah Simmons. This is Ben Gadd saying goodbye, and thanks so much to all of you for doing this, and of course to the Canadian Mountain Network for making this podcast possible. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Merci.
Bye.
Special thanks to our panelists, to Ben Gadd, our host, and to the University of Alberta and the Faculty of Science for supporting this podcast.